The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.
All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot-button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly with the Internet Law Center here in Santa Monica, California. We've got a beautiful day here. Please be seated. Today we have a very special guest, a man some of you, many of you may know, a lawyer named Timothy Walton. He's been one of the most active lawyers in the spam sector, but on the plaintiff side. So many of you may have first been introduced to him by a letter saying complaining about something your client or something you may have done. So, Timothy, are you with us?
Yes. Good morning.
So the Balsam v. Trancos is a curious case. First of all, the $7,000 judgment, is this a good use of resources to not only have a going to trial over $7,000, but to actually have an appellate decision and a whole process over $7,000?
Well, it was really the defendant, I think, that made it necessary. The defendant, a sender of email marketing, refused to believe that what it was doing was in any way a violation of law. And so the people that were making the decisions in this case really wanted to stand on principle and have a court decide. And so that is what happened.
And so at this point, the trial judgment included, I believe, was it $83,000 in attorney's fees?
Yes.
And now the appellate fees will be added, or was that both sides will bear their costs?
The appellate court awarded fees and costs.
So that's a big jump from $7,000. So let's get to the heart of the case. Basically, your client, Dan Balsam, who you represented on over at least 20 cases or more, was suing Trancos for seven emails, was it?
Eight, originally.
Eight. And because it was eight, that would be an $8,000 judgment.
There was one advertiser that the trial court felt was good enough to not warrant liability.
So if it's only eight cases, why not go small claims?
Well, at that time, the small claims limit was $7,500.
Okay.
But the other thing was that Dan Balsam really wanted to get equitable relief, an injunction that would require the sender to comply with the law. And that is not something you can get in small claims.
And did he get that? I forget.
No.
Have you ever been successful in getting, other than default actions, have you been successful in getting equitable relief? Under the
only
California
through either default actions or stipulations.
Okay. So
I've never had a court award an injunction over the objection of the spammer.
Okay. So Trancos goes to trial, and this would have been, 2009?
Yeah, about that. I think it was May of 2009.
And it goes to trial, and the judgment comes down for $7,000, so you won on seven of the eight emails.
Right.
How long was the trial?
I think it was a five-day trial.
So that was practically a day for each email. Amazing.
And yeah.
It goes.
There's always a lot of legal wrangling that goes on.
I'm sorry?
there's always a lot of legal wrangling about specific issues and whether evidence will be admitted or not. And then the testimony of the witnesses, in particular the parties, took up a fair amount of time.
And that's presenting your case.
Right.
And so you come down with a $7,000 judgment, and then it goes up on appeal. And so we just got the decision, 2 weeks ago, I believe?
Yep. February 24th,
the decision comes down. And not even 2 weeks, I guess. And the decision is in favor of your client, Dan Balsam, so a win for you. And but the thing that is – although he actually your client had made a claim that he should be entitled to recovery under the Consumer Legal Remedies Act, and his appeal there was denied, correct?
Right. That was not seeking damages. That was the injunction.
Okay. And so but the big thing on appeal was that in your case, and what was the decision as to whether or not, at the trial level, whether or not the email from addresses were misleading?
Well, I think that there were three different things that the court noticed on appeal. And in context, what it really came down to was an admonition that senders of email marketing should not try to hide their identities. And so the three issues that the appellate court focused on were proxy registration of domain names, the use of from names that included purported business entities that were not legitimately registered, and then an address in the body of the email that used a mailboxes, et cetera, where the registration of the mailboxes, et cetera, account was using information that was inaccurate. So the spammer in this case, the sender of the email, went to some great length to hide. And part of the testimony that the CEO gave at trial was to explain why they really wanted to hide from the recipients of their email. And it was because they would get angry telephone calls. And they felt that they were being harassed by people who didn't want to receive their email. And so they felt it necessary to hide.
Although, Tim, I recall, I remember the FTC had their workshop in 2003 on that kind of led up to the enactment of canned spam. And at that time, both anti-spam activists and email marketers, the issue was so charged that both sides reporting getting death threats. So, I mean, there is some basis there.
Sure. But the court's position essentially was it's not fair to send out millions of email advertisements and not provide a true opportunity for people to complain about it. The only method of complaining about the spam was either to opt out, which in essence means telling a spammer that your email address is actually being used and viewed, or sending communication to the proxy registration service and hoping that it gets forwarded and that the actual spammer will act on it. And the court said something very interesting in this regard, which was that there's no incentive for a spammer to actually remove somebody's email from their database. It just costs them money to remove it, whereas if they keep it, then they could make money.
But that's actually not true, Because there's a liability under the CAN-SPAM Act and a potential liability to whoever else they market on behalf of.
Well, there's the only liability under the CAN-SPAM Act relies on either the government or an ISP to enforce it. So recipients like Dan Balsam don't have standing under CAN-SPAM.
True. Now, the other thing is there any evidence that the privacy registrations don't forward the information? Because it sounds like, you know, Tranco's, you got in touch with them.
There is some evidence in this regard, although it didn't come up in this particular case, the Tranco's case. But efforts to enforce the ICANN registrar agreement in the past have not been wholly successful. And to a certain extent, I think that this issue is still somewhat up in the air. And while there are good reasons for privately registering a domain name, the main reason that everybody puts forward is that they don't want to get spam. And so when a spammer privately registers a domain name for the purpose of avoiding spam, it's a little hypocritical. And CAN-SPAM actually addresses this as well and says that it's a factor if a sender registers more than two domain names for the purpose of sending spam in this private way.
The when CAN-SPAM came out and there was the whole issue of what address must be disclosed, I was somewhat surprised when the FTC allowed mailboxes, because initially it was supposed to be physical addresses, but I think they relented at that time there actually were, you know, physical threats being made. And I wonder what their view of that is now. But so let's get to the meat then in your appeal. Let me step back for a second. The you have a case pending against one of the registrars, no?
Yes, that's correct.
And that's on this very issue, correct?
The issue of proxy registration.
Okay, and I want to ask you to talk about that, but I just so we know that, you know, if people want to look, what case is that? If people want to look up that.
Again, that's a Dan Balsam case where he has sued Moniker.
Okay, and so. In this case, the court made some decisions based on the fact that there was privacy registration. And where did they come down?
Well, in essence, the court said that privacy registration is itself a violation of California law. They said, we therefore hold, consistent with the trial court's ruling, that header information in a commercial email is falsified or misrepresented for purposes of the law when it uses a sender domain name that neither identifies the actual sender on its face nor is readily traceable to the sender using a publicly available online database such as Whois.
But, so when
so it really comes down to the readily traceable.
You know, 'cause it is readily
traceable. How traceable does the sender have to be?
Right. That's a question.
And in this case, it required that Balsam send a subpoena to the Mailboxes Etc. store just to chase down a fake registration of a non-existent business entity. And I think that the court decided that that was not readily traceable.
But aren't you confusing the concept of, I mean, people have trade names. They don't have to incorporate every trade name, nor do they have to file a DBA for every trade name. You know, there's a benefit to doing so, but there's nothing wrong with having trade names that aren't registered.
I'm not sure that I agree with that. I think that if somebody is using the internet for legitimate business purposes, then it makes sense to want to be found. And if there's a great attempt to hide, then it suggests, anyway, that there's something to hide.
Well, I mean, I don't know if that's true in every case. So that's the thing. I just think it's a leap to assume that just because a trade name's not registered, that somehow it's not a valid name. And I also think this you run into the problem under canned spam, where there's language in legislative history that states aren't to be allowed to prescribe a certain format for from lines.
And well, the court was not saying that it had to be this way.
We haven't talked about.
What they were finding was that the actual names that were used here were things like your business and generic dating. And I'm not sure that those would rise to the level of a protectable trademark, even in the common law trademark context.
But even again, I mean, that's not a requirement for a trade name. I mean, I could have a trade name that says cold beer, but doesn't mean I can get it trademarked. It means I may have a lot of people come by on Friday. But
it also means that if you're sending out email that just uses that name, then it's awfully hard to decide who the actual sender is.
And that's really the issue. Now, the one thing we haven't mentioned is that there's an intervening event between the trial and the appeal, and that's the Supreme Court decision in Kleffman.
And another decision in HyperTouch versus ValueClick.
Correct. But in terms of on the from line, the Kleffman was very much an important part of this ruling, where in Kleffman, which held that if you basically, Kleffman was arguing that emails using nonsensical domains, things that aren't even words, for the purposes of evading filters, is misleading and improper under the California law. And the Supreme Court said, the fact that it's nonsensical doesn't mean anything. It doesn't convey a false fact, only if it's not a valid email address. Then that is a false fact.
Well, I think the Kleffman case was extremely limited because it was only decided based upon a question certified by the Ninth Circuit. But
correct.
The Trancos Court pointed out the differences between that situation and this one.
Right.
For example, in Kleffman, the parties admitted that the domain names were readily traceable.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not privately registered.
But I just mentioned that because a lot of the decision on this issue was driven by drawing the distinction between Kleffman and the Balsam and the Trancos case.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, where does this leave private domain registration for email marketers in California today?
Well, I think it's, in general, a bad idea. And I don't think you're going to be surprised to hear me say that. But I think that it's one thing to have a website domain name that is privately registered. And it's another thing to send unsolicited commercial email using a privately registered domain name.
Let me
ask
you this.
With a website, somebody has to go there and find it, right?
Right.
And typically a website is going to include other contact information on it. Whereas unsolicited email, by definition, is not something that the recipient asked for.
So let me ask you this. I set up an email address, a website, and it's privately registered, sammymcspammy.com.
Okay.
And on that site is information for how to contact the Sammy McSpammy team.
Okay.
And but the domain is privately registered. And I send email from the world famous Sammy McSpammy domain to your clients. Where does that fall in your view?
Well, I think that's a harder case. And hard cases make for bad law, but in this case, it's somewhat in between. And in fact, most senders of email marketing don't do that. In this case, Trancos could have sent email that came from Trancos.com, but they didn't want to. They had separate domain names that were privately registered.
Right, but I mean, in essence, we're gonna take a, when we come back. We're gonna take a short break. When we come back, we'll pursue this a little bit further. But we're talking to Timothy Wallen, and you're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report on Webmaster Radio.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Johnson, what's this mantis I keep hearing about? Do we need to call an exterminator?
No, sir. Moby Mantis is our new SMS marketing tool.
SM what?
SMS. Text messaging. Moby Mantis lets us communicate directly with our customers in real time. We can send promos, coupons. It even lets our customers market for us by sharing offers with their friends online. It's been great for business.
Sounds expensive.
Actually, I signed us up for an extended free trial. It hasn't cost us a dime.
Good work, Johnson. I guess the only thing we'll be exterminating is the competition.
To get your free extended trial of Moby Mantis, text RADIO to 21691. That's RADIO to 21691 for Moby Mantis.
November 16th, 2004.
The beginning of WebmasterRadio.fm and its immediate impact on the internet business world.
Ad tech.
AFCON.
Search engine strategies.
Conversion conference.
Search bash.
Affiliate bash.
We bring you the most extensive and detailed trade show coverage, coast to coast and worldwide.
Trade show coverage delivered your way. Download it on demand now
on webmasterradio.fm.
It's time for the 2012 SCS Conference and Expo to make its way back to the Big Apple. New York City. SCS New York 2011 makes its way to the New York Hilton
March 19th through the 23rd.
SCS New York 2011 will feature over 70 sessions, nearly 100 exhibitors, and networking opportunities with thousands of marketing and search engine optimization professionals. SCS New York 2011 will start with a high-profile opening keynote from Google's digital marketing evangelist, Avinash Kaushik. Don't delay. Come to SCS New York 2012,
March 19th through the 23rd,
inside the New York Hilton. Register right now at searchenginestrategies.com. That's searchenginestrategies.com.
WebmasterRadio.fm. Welcome to the place your competitors get their edge. Jump on it. We're here for you 24/7.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back, and we're here with Timothy Walton, and we're talking about his recent victory in the court of appeal in Balsam v. Trancos. Tim, I completely forgot what question I was going to ask you before the break.
Well, you set up this weird hypothetical that doesn't, in my opinion, match reality, but suggesting that if a domain name is privately registered and there's a website at it and they use it to send email, then is that a violation of law? And the reason I don't think it matches with reality is that in most cases, the senders don't really want the sender domain name matched back to them. And so they privately register the domain names that they're using to send email, but then for their own website address where they want their customers to find them, that contains all sorts of contact information that makes it easy to find them.
Well, I mean, there's also issues of, you know, email filters too that I think drive it. Now, but it seems that the decision wasn't necessarily just, we're going to make this decision based just on whether or not it's privately registered. It's like, that's a very important factor, but we're going to look at these other things about whether or not you can find the name elsewhere.
Right. I think it was, to a certain extent, the totality of circumstances here that made the appellate court look askance at the claims of the defendant. And there are some companies that send spam that go to great efforts to hide, and for good reason, because they don't want to deal with the bounce backs, they don't want to deal with the unsubscribes, they don't want to deal with the angry recipients. And some companies go to more efforts than others. Trancos actually is not the worst offender, in my opinion, that I've run across, but they're right up there. I mean, they actually created this mailboxes, etc. address, and then when they signed the forms for the mailboxes, etc., they used a fake name. And so it just made it really, really difficult to get a hold of them. And when Dan Balsam sent mail, certified mail, to the address in the email, it was ignored.
So, Timothy, we only got a few minutes left. In the time we have, can you tell us, one, do you expect there to be an appeal to the Supreme Court? And two, how can people follow you, and what's your next activity?
I am told that Trancos is intending to follow through on its opportunities for reconsideration and or appeal. Mm-hmm. I think that their time is obviously still running. So who knows what the future holds. I don't think that they're likely to prevail based on the opinion that's come out. As far as what I'm doing in this regard in other areas, my intent is to expand everybody's understanding of the law so that marketers can know where the bright lines are and recipients can understand what their rights are in this regard, with the hope that someday people who don't want to get spam can filter it, and people who do can get it, and not worry that the sender is some shady guy in Czechoslovakia or Russia hawking fake watches.
Oh, no. Now you did it. Now we're going to get calls from the embassy in Czechoslovakia. Timothy, it's been a pleasure. And as always, I'm sorry our time was short, but do stay in touch and hope you consider coming back as this case or your other cases progress. And everyone, this is Timothy Walton, and probably the leading anti-spam internet attorney in the U.S., and it's always been a pleasure, Tim. Have a good day.
Thank you very much.
So in a few minutes, we're going to be joined by John Nicholson, who is with Pillsbury Madison. Don't know their full name, actually, because they merged with several other prominent firms. I think it's Pillsbury Madison, Shaw Pittman. It's a very respected firm in D.C. And his background is in cybersecurity. And he actually has counseled a lot of clients in this area. In addition, he has a quite unique background. He was a physicist with the U.S. Department of Energy's Superconducting Super Collider Program. And so he's no slouch, that's for sure. And it's interesting. This is a good day to get guests from D.C. because you have both the ACC and the Big East tournament going on. And I just recall that this time of year, all of a sudden, a lot of people ended up having meetings outside, and they would sneak into little restaurants and trying to watch the game during the afternoon. But luckily, we got John Nicholson. John, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
And thank you for joining us. I noticed you went to Vanderbilt. Is the SET tournament going on now too?
I gotta admit that I'm not a big basketball fan. I'm an annual basketball fan once March Madness starts and there's some money on the line, but I actually don't know the answer. I hope I do better with the rest of your question.
Well, it wasn't your undergrad anyway. So John, we got some bills pending in Capitol Hill on cybersecurity. It seems to be a partisan battle over, you know, which way to approach it. But we just had a week in which the FBI director said that the threat from cyber attacks is actually equal to or greater than the threat from terrorism. And so could you give us just a brief overview of where we are on the cybersecurity legislation and really what's at the meat of the issue?
Well, I think you're right to characterize it as a partisan issue, but that's not that big of a challenge given that everything on the Hill these days is a partisan issue.
Yeah, I think they vote over whether or not to have air conditioning on weekends, and that that gets a filibuster.
Yeah, and I mean, when you know what it's like here in the summer, for them to disagree on that gives you a testament to just how much they disagree over everything. But the FBI director's statement is probably correct because, you know, terrorism, although it is dramatic and has significant impact, certainly for those involved and for the economy, doesn't have the type of ongoing and persistent impact that problems with cybersecurity have. And those kinds of issues are things that can affect our competitiveness and can affect industry and could theoretically affect life, health, and safety for years, if not decades, to come. So I think it's absolutely correct to characterize the level of that threat. There was a Norton study in 2011 that calculated the global cost of cybercrime at around $114 billion, and when they added in the combined value of time lost by victims in terms of data breaches and other things, they brought that up to $388 billion, which brings it up well past the realm of most global drug trafficking.
Wow,
and
incredible.
And so when you start to think about that, go
along
ahead, sorry.
The magnitude or even greater than, you know, a hurricane.
Yeah. And a hurricane is just, you know, it's a natural disaster. We can prepare for it. We can mitigate against it. And we should be doing the same kind of preparation and mitigation at a national level to deal with this same problem.
That brings us to a question that I have, and it seems that there's little market incentive to really address exposure or the kind of lack of preparedness that may exist for cybersecurity. You know, the consequences only occur when there's a breach and it becomes public. And even then, the SEC has just promulgated rules for when you must disclose such an event. Is there really a market incentive to have adequate security?
I think there is a market incentive. Larry Poneman and the Poneman Institute do an annual survey of data breaches and other similar incidents, and a significant part of the damage that they calculate associated with data breaches is customer churn and customers who will not participate in or will not use a given store or a given service after a data breach if they don't feel like they've been sufficiently protected and the company is not sufficiently apologetic. So at the most basic, if you're a consumer-facing organization and you've got those kinds of issues, then there's a significant potential cost there.
So, in breaking down what's pending on Capitol Hill, you do have the first issue is data breaches. And, I mean, there it seems to be a crying need for legislation because we have, 30 or 40 more, states that have their own versions of data breach requirements, and there's a benefit to having a single uniform standard so that it's clear and it applies at all states.
Absolutely true. I mean, I think I and those of my fellow lawyers who help companies deal with those data breaches are probably the only people who would like to see the current fragmented standard continue. Because if there's only one standard, then that's pretty easy to respond to. 47 different states, they got to call me.
I have a feeling they'll still be calling you. But what are the other issues in contention then?
Well, the real question is, the real fundamental question is levels of control, involvement, and information sharing. To what degree should the government be specifying any kind of security standards? To what degree should they be mandating information sharing about cybersecurity incidents? And to what degree should companies be protected if they share that information with the government? And who in the government is going to be driving the bus as far as this is concerned? And those are some of the real sort of fundamental differences between the various bills that are on the Hill right now. And they reflect some of the fundamental philosophical differences between the Republicans and the Democrats.
Right. And do we have any models to look at? I mean, have the European Union or Japan or Canada addressed this in a way that can give us an example of how this should or should not be done?
From a cybersecurity perspective, not really. Different approaches have been taken around the world towards different things, and we really took the lead in data breach notification legislation, and that's why we have 47 different states with those laws, whereas the Europeans and most of the rest of the world actually took a more privacy-centric approach to dealing with personal information, but not necessarily cybersecurity. And part of that is just simply because the U.S. has taken a much more technological approach. And so many of the technology companies are here. So many of the sort of fundamental components of the Internet are here in Virginia. And we've tended to focus more on cybersecurity because it's been more of an issue here.
And you hear a lot of alarm bells that have been rung over both our military's readiness to respond to cybersecurity issues as well as in the private sector. And what do you think the current state is in that regard, particularly the private sector?
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm referring to the private sector. How prepared are we for the cyber threats that are out there?
I saw an interesting report recently, a capstone paper from, and now I'm blanking on his name, but one of the things, it analyzed the threat from China, and one of the things he said was basically, if you think you're not going to be hacked, you're wrong, and if you think you haven't been hacked, you're also wrong. I was talking recently to a friend of mine who does cybersecurity for a telecom company, and that person basically just said, I'm increasingly of the belief that we've all been hacked, and some of us just don't realize it yet.
Wow. So that's definitely an alarm bell to be rung, but...
Yeah.
An election year may not get heard.
Well, it'll be heard, and the alarm bell will be rung by a number of people in order to drive sufficient fear to support their own particular agenda.
Now, are we near any votes coming up? I know the Senate Judiciary was trying to report out a bill to the Senate floor for a vote, and the Republicans were objecting to that. Is it likely that we'll have any votes anytime soon on this?
It's hard to tell. I mean, they're so wrapped up in fighting with each other. I mean, to get into some of the bills, I mean, right now we've got the Cybersecurity Act of 2012, which is in the Senate, which is sponsored by Lieberman, Collins, Rockefeller, Feinstein, and others. And Senator Reid supports that bill, and his original intention was to bring it directly to the floor. And the Republicans have said that they want that bill to go through all of the major committees that might have jurisdiction: Commerce, Judiciary, Energy, Intelligence, Homeland Security.
Small business. And then in 2014, when they're done?
Yeah, and I mean, that bill was already covered in both Homeland Security and Commerce, and it's the result of bills that were worked on through hearings over the last 3 years in both of those committees, and they finally combined the two bills that had been reported out of those two committees to create the Cybersecurity Act of 2012. So, you know, it's had a fair amount of work done on it already. But, you know, the Republicans would like to stall it if they can. If they can't stall it, they've got an alternative to it, and it'll be interesting to see what happens with that one.
And is the alternative bill, is it kind of relying heavily on laissez-faire to, the genius of the market will solve the problem, or?
It certainly more than the bipartisan bill. The Republicans' bill, the Secure IT Act, which stands for Strengthening and Enhancing Cybersecurity by Using Research, Education, Information, and Technology Act.
Yeah, I always think that must be the most highest paid person on Capitol Hill. You know, the person that comes up with the names that so he can fit the catchy abbreviation and use that. Like can spam or whatever. That person,
right.
It must be great in New York Times crossword puzzles.
It probably is. At least with this one, McCain had the decency to say that whoever came up with that piece of sausage ought to be fired. there are a lot of prominent Republicans who are trying to put this one forward. McCain, Kay Bailey Hutchison, Chuck Grassley, Saxby Chambliss, Lisa Murkowski, and a few others. And it really does stress voluntary information sharing. And it really focuses more on pushing the NSA and the Air Force's Cyber Command as the lead entities for dealing with this problem, whereas the bipartisan bill pushes DHS much more.
Why the difference? Is one because it could be have enforcement authority?
The Secure IT Act actually does include a criminal element. But there are a number of people who have commented on the Republicans' proposal. The ACLU is very concerned. The Center for Democracy and Technology is concerned. Even Richard Clark said that having NSA and Cyber Command as the face of this effort makes no sense.
Huh. And Richard Clark is a former national security advisor.
Yes. You'd like to think he knows what he's talking about.
We always like that.
So under the Republican bill, information could be provided to these cybersecurity centers that would be established, and private companies would send data to them that would document network activity or protocols known to be associated with malicious cyber actors or that might signify malicious intent. Now, unfortunately, those terms are pretty broad, and the Act itself doesn't actually define what network activity is or what malicious intent is.
Wow.
You could have people dumping information into these cybersecurity exchanges without really any clear guidance as to what they're supposed to be providing.
So where do you see this going? We have an election year, so it's going to be a shortened schedule. We'll have a break, probably from mid-July to early September for the conventions, and another break, early October to Election Day. Is there time or is there a will to get anything done this year?
Oh, I, I think it depends. A lot depends on what happens. I mean, the incidents like Anonymous attacking various websites tend to raise concern, sometimes concern that's in excess of the amount of damage they've actually done. The things that Anonymous and LulzSec and some of the other activists do raise concerns, but they don't actually highlight the real problem. And the underlying problem is the attacks on our infrastructure and the attacks on our companies and our systems that are sucking away information, sucking out intellectual property, and really doing serious harm to U.S. companies and global companies' ability to compete. And then you get into the issues of confidential information, potential access to other very sensitive information, and you start seeing a lot of things where there's an enormous risk out there, but it's really bubbling under the surface. And a lot of the people who are, a lot of the congressmen and senators who are trying to take action in this area recognize the problem. And they recognize the desperate need to do something about this. But there's so much paralysis and suspicion. And, you know, they've done things badly in the past. I mean, SOPA and PIPA come to mind,
right,
where there is so much sensitivity in the community, in the technology industry, and just so much distrust of and dislike for Congress and government in the public that it's hard for them to actually muster the political capital and the political will to push these things forward.
But isn't it hard to muster political capital on an issue like this just because it's so technical? I mean, I think SOPA is an exception because they were able to kind of get the zeitgeist, but...
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, and that's an excellent point. It's hard to get people excited about this, even though this is something that really
except
affects
our listeners.
because it's so hard to understand. It's hard to get energy around it.
So we only have a few minutes left. So why don't you tell us where people can contact you and some of the things that you're going to be up to?
Oh, well, I can be reached at, I'm an attorney with Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman, and you can reach me at John, J-O-H-N, dot Nicholson, N-I-C-H-O-L-S-O-N, at Pillsbury Law, PillsburyLaw.com. And we have to add the law to that to distinguish ourselves from the Pillsbury Doughboy.
I won't try to do the giggle.
I can't either, despite my personal resemblance.
Now, are you presenting anywhere soon?
I don't have anything going on right now. I've got a couple of deals that I'm working on that are taking up most of my time. And then my wife and I are actually having a baby in May, so the idea of me flying off and presenting anything... does not make her happy.
No, I can imagine. You want to make sure that when they have the medical instruments, they're not going to be aimed at you.
Yep, and she knows where I sleep.
That helps. So, well, it's been a pleasure, John. I appreciate you joining us, and we may call you back as things progress on Capitol Hill, if that happens. But thank you again. I hope you'll come back. Everyone, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. We've had an interesting discussion on spam and cybersecurity. Next week, we're going to have Mike Zanis from the Interactive Advertising Bureau, yes, the IAB, to talk about the president's new initiative, the Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights. So join us next week when we have Mike Zanis from the IAB on. Hope your fortunes do well on this championship week in college basketball. And then as the March Madness begins, we'll be joining you next week here. And this is Bennett Kelly with the Internet Law Center saying, court is adjourned. Listen for us on webmasterradio.fm or download us on iTunes. And please spread the word. Thanks again, everyone. Have a good week.